Welcome to the El Arpa podcast, the home for cultural chit-chat in and outside Madrid. People will talk. Welcome to the El Arpa podcast. This is your host, Anonymous. And Mary, how are you doing?
I'm good, thank you. I thought you forgot your name there.
I forgot what I was going to say, but here we are anyway, firmly established in terra firma of part one of the podcast. So, rumor has it that you're going to be working with a big bunch of farmers next week. Please explain.
I can't tell you anything. I don't know yet. It's just a fair.
Okay. Because 2 years ago you worked at a tourist stall of the fair.
Yes. Well, the India tourism port, basically.
And remind me again, what part of India are you from?
Alright, I'm not Indian, but I need people who could speak English.
Okay. In fact, I've been teaching IELTS to a private student, and there's an Indian girl who did the IELTS speaking, and she speaks fantastically and very nice accent as well. So I might ask you if you can replicate that in part three of the show. But nevertheless, I can't leave you alone for 2 minutes, because last time you went to that show, you came back covered head to toe in hentai.
Henna?
Henna, that's the word, yeah.
Hentai.
I don't know.
What the hell?
It's a Japanese thing, I think.
Henna, yes, henna, but no head to toe, just the hands.
Oh, yeah. Took months to wash off.
Well, it took a while, for it to go.
So you don't know what you're going to be doing in this?
I don't know exactly, no. Well, providing information of some kind.
Okay, so, well, obviously, in this part, we have to stretch it out a bit more. So we'll just do small talk. You've been watching a show about rituals.
Uh-huh.
Yeah, you better tell us that, or else I'll have to like Google New York Times or The Guardian and see what's in the headlines.
No, it's a BBC documentary.
Yeah.
And it's just really interesting because, well, things about rituals have been done before, of course. But I think it's just a nice summary because it also uses like very kind of like innovative filming techniques. And
Such as,
I don't know the technical names, but I don't know, just it's very vibrant, and some angles that you don't normally see, because they work very closely with the people that are undergoing like rituals, such as, well, the one I've watched so far, the first one was like introductory, and the second one was about initiation rites.
Okay, in what kind
all
of...
All over the world.
Yeah.
And both like now, like modern ones and ancestral ones. Like obviously most of them are traditional ones that the communities have had through like millennia, but others are relatively new ones.
This is a serious question now before you start laughing, but do they involve college hazing and fraternities and those things?
Oh, well, as a matter of fact, they actually mention them. As a replication of those kind of ancestral rituals. So yeah, I mean, the fraternities and all these kind of American traditions, they are based on like Greek, like customs and stuff like that.
Yeah, because they're all named after Greek chapters, no?
No, they are named after Greek chapters because they are based on like the Greek tribal
You're telling me Socrates had to do a keg stand.
No, but I mean, of course, like it's just, to be honest, both that, I think it's good because both that and the Spanish Easter feature as like small parts of it, but obviously, Spanish Easter has far more of a tradition. But it's nice because it sort of like counteracts and balances out the other bits that you see from cultures that, you know, you've never even heard of.
Okay, sounds intriguing. And speaking of kind of cultural stories, you must be familiar with the Pied Piper of Hamilton. Not Hamilton, that's another musical. The Pied Piper.
Of Hamilton.
The Pied Piper of Wicked.
As you say, you played on a live one.
You're familiar with the story, no?
Of Hamilton.
No. Not the hit musical Hamilton. The Pied Piper story.
Of Hamilton.
Oh, Hamelin, sorry, yeah.
yes, of course, I'm familiar with it.
Do you know what pied means?
Pied?
No, pied.
Oh, yes. Oh, yeah. I don't know because it's... I don't know why you call it like that in English.
It's multicolored. So he's basically a wandering musician who wore colorful clothes and he became the Pied Piper. People say it's an allegory for fiscal responsibility as well. So very German.
They were only green.
Are you thinking of Robin Hood?
Same thing.
Yeah, no, very different stories.
Well, you they wore the same clothes.
No, it's very interesting. Well, no, they didn't because the Pied Piper wore multicolored clothes and Robin Hood wore a very specific type of costume.
I think you're getting a lot with Joseph.
The Technicolor Dreamcoat. Yes. No, that's another guy who wore multicolored clothes.
Okay.
Anyway, so the Pied Piper, it's actually, people think, based on a true story. And they have that in mind because like in the town where it happened you hear accounts of it, and also they built a gate at the edge of the city which dated the history of the town from that momentous occasion where when the story is said to take place. And also there's a very famous church window as well depicting the story, which has been since destroyed, and other towns around in the surrounding area also started talking about the story as well. So there's a very credible idea that this was a real story, and then, you know, that begs the question, what does a story actually mean? So some people think, well, in Transylvania and Romania, when Germans were settling the land there, it kind of represented the children, the youth, leaving the town. So not that it's the children, but the children of this of the town in the kind of bigger sense. No, also other people think perhaps the bubonic plague, so the rats obviously would have a story there as well. So it's like the children dying and you have to invent a story about why they died as well. And also as well, there's even darker things. One is like that a lot of children were killed or sacrificed. So there's lots of theories. But whatever it is, people, like, you know, stories, a lot of stories that people have put forth are theories. The town itself has a part to play. They have some guilt, some blame. And that's why in the story they've written, they kind of wanted to talk about what happened. But maybe they're using allegory because it's too painful to actually describe what really happened. But also in the story, their guilt is also reflected because, as you might remember, the good people of Hamelin, not Hamilton, refused to pay him what they owed him for his services rendered. So, I don't know, it's a big ball of mystery anyway, but I think it's kind of interesting, that little bit of departure. No?
Yes, definitely. I didn't know about all that, to be honest.
Well, there is a documentary I've been watching as well, but wow, you know what? I think we'll save that for part three.
Okay.
And then in part two, we're going to be talking about gentrification and a neighborhood in Madrid. So stay tuned for that, dear listener. Anything else you want to say?
No.
Okay. This is part two. So Mary, we've been doing a lot of tours lately.
Yay!
Yeah, it's been great, hasn't it?
It has.
So we've been making the big bucks doing that. But also we've been learning a lot more about our barrio, about our neighborhood. We already knew a lot, that's why we started a tour. But then we panicked and thought, oh, maybe we need a little bit more information. And maybe we did, I don't know. But we did find out some cool things as well. So all of the stops that we're doing in Lava PS, which we have mentioned before as well, what are the ones, what's the trivia that you like?
I like all the parts about the tiles. Oh. There are a lot of facades that are decorated with traditional tiles. And it's just nice, for example, to know the color code, which like what color they use for each shop and so on.
Okay. Can you give us an example of just one color? Just one. Look, our listener in St. Helens or there's one
Atlanta.
Atlanta. They probably won't be here ever,
I
so
know, but they can download the app
it's true.
on Android.
And
Coming soon on
we figured that out
iOS
actually,
2.
but they could do a virtual Google tour with our app as well.
Yeah. Okay, I'll tell you one. So basically, white fork milk shops.
Okay.
And that way I don't give away too much.
Wow, KG. I'm gonna be more liberal and tell you a lot more.
Okay, then.
But it's okay. No, there's actually so much to say. But a lot of stories that we have are very human centered, and you can really touch the story in a way that makes sense. I mean, for example, Gloria Fuertes, great Spanish writer. You can actually sit where she sat, dip your bread into wine and rice, like she did in a bar here in Madrid as well, which is, I think, quite interesting. Also, an anecdote about that, Spanish soldiers that killed French soldiers in the Segunda de Mayo uprising hid in the barrels in the cellar there, and then people used to go there afterwards and kind of drink the wine from those barrels and toast those soldiers and drink to the sweet revenge against the French. Nice, no? Well, it just
That
like,
went lovely.
well, not pretty nice, but it's an interesting story. But also, I'll tell you one more. I'll tell you one more. There's a bullfighter we talk about on the tour as well, and I thought it was interesting because he was a sensation, a young hotshot bullfighter. sorry, I'm turning into the spiel
Not
here.
that cliché at all.
This is the patter I do during the tour, but he died when he was 20, and he died in Valencia. So yeah, the story you can find on the app as well, which can be downloaded on Android, or if you're in Madrid on the tour. But needless to say, though, going up like the week up to his death, he started having dreams and premonitions that he was going to die. What else was he doing? Also, he was going to gypsy fortune tellers, who also were going to tell him he was going to die. And he started smelling. I remember he started smelling funeral candles, whether or not. So he could just be in a room or on the street. And he'd get that scent of the candles you'd use in a funeral service, and that would fill his nostrils and give him a vague sense of dread. He dispatched his first bull on that fateful day in Valencia, and then started confidently against the second, but the bull soon finished with him. I won't go into great details, but it was very gory. But a picture of him prostrate and dead does feature in Ernest Hemingway's Death in the Afternoon. So, interesting. So the reason we kind of started off talking about Love PS is not just because we want to plug the tour or the app, though both are beneficial to us. It's because Time Out magazine last week called, dubbed, named Love PS as the coolest neighborhood in the world. Now, I live here, so I have thoughts about that as well. Did you heard about that independently of me, didn't you? Or did you hear that from me directly?
From you directly.
Ah, very nice. Like most interesting things, no?
Of course, I mean.
But what was your reaction when I told you that?
Meh, I don't know, like I've never liked to interested in those like rankings and things like that because then they throw out really strange results.
Well, the reaction on Twitter was pretty interesting because most of the initial reaction, maybe for the first day or two, was from residents. It's like, yeah, sure, it's the coolest neighborhood in the world. Now, what about these social problems? So that was a very common reaction. Then you start getting businesses capitalizing on it, going, find out why we're the coolest neighborhood in the world. Come to Paco's Bar. Not a real bar, and see the atmosphere and kind of drink it in, no pun intended. But I think the reaction of the real people or the people living here was very revealing because it's also a thing I would feel myself that it's a great neighborhood. As we said before, it has a lot of culture. The mo of all the neighborhoods in Madrid, it has the most cultural associations and community-run initiatives. You have amazing buildings like the Tabacalera, which is a former cigarette factory, tobacco factory, and it's been converted into a cultural space that you can rent out if you want, and put on a show there in terms of photography or even a theater piece. For example, Cine Dore, also a stop on our tour as well, something that links back to the great days of Spanish cinema in the 20s, has been reopened since 1989, also tells a lot of great stories as well. So there's so much beauty here. But for example, every day I smell pee on my street. I've seen people taking heroin in front of my door. And at the weekend, as I said to you off podcast as well, I saw a homeless man masturbating between two cars. So, yeah, the coolest neighborhood in the world. No, I'm not knocking him. I mean, you know, it's not for me to judge, but it's not something that you want to see, particularly, or not generally a marker of the coolest neighborhood in the world. So kind of what we want to do in this part is figure out how it happened. You know, like, how did this happen? I think it's very arbitrary anyway, because I think these kind of magazines and websites go around the world and just choose one that has a reputation. So no matter what city you go to, just ask a local or even Google it, you're going to find out which is considered the cool neighborhood or the alternative neighborhood. So it's not going to take too much research to find out. So I imagine this is like a rotating cast of like cool places. So, okay, let's go to Spain this year. Madrid's the capital, isn't it? Okay, so like, what's the cool place in Madrid? Everybody, of course, is going to say Lava PS. If you go to Berlin, I think it would. Maybe Malasaña, but I think Lava PS has a great cultural cachet in Madrid. If you go to Germany in Berlin, I'm sure there's the district there that, you know, all the artists occupy the empty buildings, and there's a lot of these community-run collectives as well. So I think it's probably... It doesn't take too much work as a journalist to figure out. And then you say, okay, this year's going to be Spain. Next year, we'll choose some place in Italy. Bada bing. There's your list, for example. But I have some problems with it as well. And I'm guessing you have as well. So I'll just say my first problem, and you can tell me what you think about it. Because I think, like, what does Lava PS have? It has a lot of Indian restaurants, has a lot of immigrants. Traditionally, it is a working class area where the poorest people in Madrid would live, apart from Vallecas as well, of course. It's also where a lot of old people would live and still do live. And that's also why you have a lot of immigration here today as well. So you have like African immigrants playing drums on a Sunday afternoon. You have the Indian restaurants. You have like the market as well. But my kind of big issue with it is like you have people who come here and see all of that. But I think it's a superficial connection between the people that live here and the people that maybe come in, either living here as gentrifiers without actually really connecting with the neighborhood, but also maybe just as tourists are here for a weekend. Because a lot of these people, you know, their stories are quite grim in a way. Because you remember as well, when they had the riots in Lava PS a few months ago, we found out the story of the guy who died, how he lived very close to here. How he shared the apartment with other people. Sometimes he was short of rent. He's spending his money on things in shops that he could later sell in the street. How he's been kind of hassled by the police sometimes as well. So these are the real stories of the people who inhabit this place, but it's not really reflected in the coolness of the markets or these lists, or it's not really being represented by anything that says this is the coolest neighborhood in the world. You know what I mean?
I know what you mean.
Yeah.
It's quite complex. You're asking me to comment on...
You can answer whatever you want. You can talk about something completely different as well.
No, I mean, I think... Well, I think that's something that is known about Lava PS, about the locals. It's almost as if it was like too superimposed realities, or three even, because when I'm walking around and kind of there's that bit of like coolness and people going together, community and all that, and also doing a lot of alternative activities, and now recently that we've joined some groups, we've seen like how many activities and cool things there are to do, and people helping each other and all that. All these people are usually the ones that you've mentioned that are coming, that have not lived here, I have not been brought up here at all.
Yeah.
Then you have all that world of the immigrants and, you know, some like drug dealing and...
Yeah, well, that's the thing. I mean, you have your social problems as well, which make a lot of sense because you understand the legal situation that a lot of people are in. But at the same time, that's connected to another issue where you have the gentrification of the neighborhood, which is a problem that happens all over the world, and you can see a lot of evidence of that in places like New York as well, in San Francisco. But where you pay incredible prices for coffee in some establishments, and then you go and you see someone taking heroin. So it doesn't really correlate, I don't think. But also, secondly, what, like, because it's a construct, you know, these kind of places that come in. Some people argue, in my opinion, wrongly, that they improve the areas, but they just price people out who can't afford those kind of things, those coffees or those burgers or those desserts, you know. And what do you want? You want a living, thriving community, right? Where you have stories. I mean, for example, we talk about in the tour, the Blue Korea, the hairdressers, where while they waited, because such a huge demand, you give them cigars and beer. So like, that's a thing. That's a cultural thing. That's a societal thing, like unique to the barrio, where there's stories and there's characters. But when you have these kind of fancy establishments coming in, what you have is just overpriced sandwiches, where it's the ideas connected to it, but it's a marketing idea connected to it rather than actually existing. And people who live there can't afford it anyway. So like, really, it's artificial as well. So the first reason it's artificial is because the people that they're kind of venerating by being cool are forgotten by society anyway. And they have a lot of like harsh living that they're living every day. And then the other thing is like, they're pushing out the things that made the barrio or the neighborhood vibrant in the first place, which are the local shops and the local restaurants and the local bars where people knew each other and could tell stories that that happen organically when people get together. And what you have is a big chain which sells, you know, probably inferior products really anyway. And it comes with bells and whistles that isn't based on any, doesn't have any roots. It's a slogan or it's a marketing thing. That's another problem though, apart from Lavapiés. It just, we should talk about it as well, which is gentrification. But you see where I'm coming from here with, you know, with this.
Yes, I think... Well, that's right. And the third group that I was thinking of was the people, like the elderly people that you say that have been living here all their lives.
Yeah.
I mean, I think like, for example, the peluqueria that you were mentioning, the hairdressers, they've been like here for the whole of the 20th century. But now they've kind of like, they haven't really reinvented themselves. They keep on like the traditions, but also... with that new fashion of like people getting their beards like trimmed and fixed and all this grooming and stuff like that, that's also like reviving the... So they get a mix of like clientele. So for example, in that case, I think that's the sort of thing that helps makes the barrio, in that it mixes two other groups. I think when we were talking about the people that have come from outside, I didn't grow up in this neighborhood, which probably pretty much is most people other than elderly people. I can't imagine there are many young people that have grown up here that are still living here.
Yeah.
I think we have to distinguish between the two groups as well within those, because there are some people that have come here because they like that there's kind of like its own, it's as if it had its own boundaries, and there are things that are kind of, to a point, more lax in a way, that even though there's police everywhere, but you know, it's kind of like there are like some internal rules and things like that. I don't know how to explain it. So there's that sense of like being protected in a way by their own people, even though there are plenty of things going on. But then there are, so a lot of those people, I feel they actually like do integrate. They do like that sort of community feeling, and they're here because of it. So for example, they do have contacts with like the black people playing the drums, or you know, they are in touch with like immigrants here and even like do things together, or even sometimes there are cultural things where they are involved together.
Yeah.
But then we have all the set of people who kind of like come here for like the cool bar or the fancy overpriced thing that you were talking about. I think those are also like concentrated on a particular side, mostly on a particular side of the neighborhood, I believe.
No, so, I think they're everywhere. Like you have a mixture like on every street of something that's very expensive,
yeah,
and very traditional as well.
Well, so in any case, I think there are like, you know, those, so not everybody that has come from the outside is looking for the same thing, I think. But I think probably the people that come because of the cool bar or whatever, they're not going to have any contact with the immigrants.
Yeah, but I think, though, like, for all the richness that you've described there, and it is true, I think it's just too arbitrary or too weak to describe that as being cool, because there's so many.
Oh, no, of course.
That's why I don't, like, a lot of people, I think, don't really like that ranking, because there's so many stories there and so many backgrounds and so many kind of realities that that do kind of fuse together very often in very nice ways. But you know, to say that it's organic, it's real, but to say that it's cool seems very...
Yeah, I mean, I don't think the reason why they say it's cool is because there are people coming from the outside that like the sense of community and play drums with the Africans.
Yeah.
I think the reason why they say it's cool is because there are like some these fancy establishments precisely that we are kind of like complaining about in a way, you know what I mean?
So I
think that's the reason, because is the mixture of like lots of things going on, like I don't know, one of shops that might not be in other places, and that whole thing in kind of like hipster culture.
Well, hipster culture, yeah, for sure. But another thing connected to that, a lot of people don't like that characteristic because they're worried about gentrification of the neighborhood. So are you familiar with the concept of gentrification?
Well, I am a bit, but you can explain it better.
It's just basically when people come in, either build something or buy low rent, something that has low price, and then convert into something and price all the people that have been living there out of it. It's something that's happening in San Francisco as well, happening in New York City, and it's probably going to happen in Lavapiés, because people are saying, yeah, Lavapiés is the new Malasaña. So Malasaña used to be a traditional neighborhood as well, and then became converted into something that was very chic and cool, and that's what's going to happen to Lavapiés. Also, if you watch videos on YouTube, you'll see a lot of comments going, it's just improving the area. What are people worried about? But like, it's just kind of, it sounds so, like, this podcast, I don't want it to sound like such a hippie rant, because you're going to be like, demand and capitalism and all that stuff. But the fact of the matter is, like, people say it generates money, but who does it generate money for? People who have enough money to invest in things anyway, and then the profits are going to be pulled out of the neighborhood. So, like, who's going to win from that?
Yeah, no, I think, sorry, I thought it was rhetorical.
It was rhetorical, because, but you can answer that as well.
Yeah, I mean, no, you're right. I don't care what it sounds either, because what it sounds like either, because it's the truth. And then it just depends. I mean, there are like certain, there are shops in this neighborhood, like in Lavapiés, where, you know, that money reverts into the community. But then there are other that are chains, or that they're like fancy places or linked to like bigger corporations. And then, of course, they don't. And probably the second group is more.
Well, like, I think as well, what the problem is that, okay, in some studies in the States, for example, New York, your house, the value of your house increases, for example. Your credit rating can also increase. But also the level of poverty also increases as well. So having a Starbucks or a franchise near you doesn't get, like, the money, what I was trying to say earlier, it doesn't spread out and eliminate the social inequality or the social issues that exist in a place. So, for example, if you have more gentrification here, which probably will happen if there's more lists like, oh, this is the coolest place ever, you know, you're not going to have the rising tide that lifts all boats, to quote a former Irish politician. You're going to have rich people that live here, and then the poor people that live on the street behind them. I think it's just another way as well to have your people that come in and serve you in the restaurants and clean your hotels, but then disappear from your view when they're not needed. And you can see that very clearly in San Francisco, because San Francisco is a place that has been really gentrified. And like, it seems like once a year you have a tech person in the Silicon Valley complaining about how homeless people ruin their trip to work in the morning and how they should be removed out of sight, for example. So it just what you have is ghettoization of people who aren't making as much money as you. And that's the kind of subtle threat of gentrification, because it's just people with money moving into an area and making it too expensive for everybody else, and then they don't have to live or interact with people with without economic means or without their kind of means, for example. So I don't know. I think it's, you know, it's a subtle thing, but I think it is something that is a threat to neighborhoods, you know. I don't know, you're from Leon as well. I don't know if that's a thing in Leon.
No, I mean, I think this is like a thing of like capital cities and big cities, or this, yeah, you know, a decent size, basically.
Yeah.
And, you know, like Leon is a provincial town, and,
yeah,
and I mean, probably they think that there's a lot of immigrants, but, you know, it's yeah, not. But no, I think that this happens in like this type of city. I think probably one of the reasons as well that for them to highlight it in Madrid, for example, is that it's kind of like rare in the sense that other big cities across the world have had immigrants for a very long time. And in reality here, this is a pretty recent thing. I mean, I remember, like, you know, I don't want to like show my age, but when I was little, I remember a point where there was nobody that was, I mean, I remember there was one kid that was from Morocco in the whole school.
Yeah.
And I remember there was a lot of like South American people coming in as like maids and nannies, things like that. But that was it, you know, like, I mean, I'm not saying that they weren't immigrants, but they were very few because we just come out of the dictatorship and, you know. So that's kind of like more, I don't know, in a way, it's easier to pick up on that because it's more, I don't know, to an outsider, it's more surprising or whatever than, you know, Soho or...
Yeah.
You know, it's something that for them they're thinking, oh, this is quite cool, because it's like, I don't know like where the magazine is based.
I think it's an American.
Yeah. One. So, yeah. I mean, you know, Mediterranean country where this is like new for them, and how cool, because
yeah,
they think we're cool anyway because
no, it is, it's like sunny. There's, you know, times, yeah, when it's sunny and like you see women in like Arabic or African dress sitting down, talking while the kids play, and you see all these men also speaking different languages, and there's a vibe to it that's quite cool, you know. So yeah, like maybe they saw it that day.
And
they based their article on it. Now, to give some balance as well, there was a Voice debate involving a comedian, an economist, and a university lecturer. University lecturer was saying that it's a good thing. He's been priced out of two neighborhoods, but he thinks overall gentrification is positive because he says, like, there's always people being moved from neighborhoods, always artists going to the poor neighborhoods, occupying the buildings, giving them a vibrancy, and their value goes up and they go somewhere else, for example, and it's cyclical. But a lot of people... a lot of people get ripped out of their homes. There's a few good documentaries on the internet, which are quite illuminating. There's one, though, the first I saw was about this African-American woman going around saying, they closed this laundromat, and they closed this laundromat, and that laundromat. So she's very upset about them closing all the laundromats. But I guess for her as well, it was a place where people either, you know, could congregate and maybe talk, but also she's saying this one was 24 hours, so if you're working shift work, which again would be a reality of people who are working class, you could still kind of go in very late at night or very early in the morning to get your clothes washed. As well. So anyway, the last thing we can talk about as well is the Tapa PS Festival, and you can describe what that is. We did a podcast about it as well.
Yeah, it's a tapas festival. So, well, what they do is that basically the bars across the neighborhood offer like a special discount on like a drink and a tapa.
Yeah. So in the context of what we've been talking about, how do you view the festival?
Well, from my point of view, it's a bit more to do with the gentrification that you were talking about, because, like, at the end of the day, for example, it's sponsored by, I can't remember, I think it's Mao. So, it's certain, like, huge brand of beer. And then all the bars are forced to, like, give you this beer.
Yeah.
So the deal is like Mao, for example, which I think it is, which it, on top of everything is awful, but for me, but that, you know, it's fixed plus their tapa or the tapa of the choice. So in reality there, well, the person who's making the most money is the corporation as well, you know?
Yeah, well...
And then the restaurants, okay, yeah, to a point, but, you know, those restaurants, people, for example, the Indian restaurants, people specifically come to this neighborhood for the Indian restaurants or the African restaurants because this is where they are, you know?
Yeah, it's something that's also replicated in other barrios in the city. But speaking of Mao, isn't that complicated by the fact as well that Mao is the beer of Madrid? You go to the south, it's maybe Estrella, I think, and it's Cruzcampo in the north.
The other way around.
Oh, whatever. Yeah, okay.
But yeah, it doesn't matter.
That, like, they've divided, because that's quite American in a way as well, where they've, like, big companies kind of decide territory, and the big beers have basically divided up Spain. Like, of course, you can go and order these other beers in Madrid bars, but if you ask for, like, a caña, like, the standard thing they'll give you in Madrid is Mao.
Yes, that is true. Yes, but, well, yeah, but even so, I mean, it's still, even if this is their market, but, you know, it's still not, like, any beer you want or any of these craft beers, for example, produced by local breweries.
Yeah, well, that's
with the tapa.
That's very true. I think it is complex because on one hand, I think, yeah, you are going to local restaurants and supporting them. But then again, like we were talking yesterday, I'm not sure if we, or not yesterday, but in the last podcast, I'm not sure if we actually mentioned this point, but we're talking that traveling is political. And one of the points in the article, in the lesson, was that that the locals have to shoulder the burden of the tourists. And that's what happens with Tapa PS as well, that people living there have to shoulder the burden of the outsiders or people from other parts of the city coming in and dominating for such a long time. So depending on your point of view as well, that can be a very negative thing. But my biggest bugbear with it is that the last time we went there, I kept asking for a fork and he wouldn't give me one. So what happened to the customers always right?
I know.
I don't know.
And you haven't forgotten all that.
But I think, though, the last thing we can probably say about this before we go to part three is that, like, every kind of festival, like, go to Munich for Oktoberfest, which is also last weekend in Madrid, or you go to, like, other festivals around Spain, they're very commercialized and probably dominated and ruined by foreigners. You know, you go to the Pamplona or Tomatina, for example. You know, it's like what became local festivals have been completely commercialized to within an inch of their life. But it has PS, I don't know, it has like a lot of commercial aspects to it, but also as well, it hasn't been too ruined, I don't think, yet by I don't know, just people coming in just to do it for an experience and kind of going away again. I don't know. I don't know. Maybe it is part of the barrio. Maybe it is part of the community. I don't know, it's complex.
I mean, I don't know. This hasn't been going on for so long. Like, it's not like a big festival or a traditional festival, which is what attracts like large crowds, you know?
Yeah.
This is like one of 20 million things happening every day within the capital.
Yeah.
So it's not something that attracts people. I mean, it wouldn't bring anybody from outside Madrid for tapas.
And before people say, hey, but you're an outsider to me, that is not you, you're Spanish, I live here and I pay my taxes. So anything else you want to say?
No.
Okay, well, we will talk to you in the third part. So welcome back to part three, and thank you very much for listening to part two and part one. So I think I enjoyed part two quite a lot, didn't you?
As always.
Okay, so that documentary, I sent you the trailer for it, accidental courtesy. Did you watch the trailer?
No, I didn't watch the trailer because I thought it was the whole thing that you sent me.
No.
So I was waiting to have time to watch the whole thing.
All 2 minutes of it. Well, I still have a second half pending, so if we have finished all our admin duties today, we can catch some of it if you want.
Okay.
Yeah?
Sounds like a plan.
Mm-hmm. Fantastic. Okay, so our admin duties, we've been doing a lot of translation stuff, so that's kind of one of it as well. Also working on our audiobook as well for the poetry, but, you know, we'll give more updates about that as they come. But the documentary is really great because it's about a black musician who played with all the greats, Chuck Berry, Roy Orbison, Elvis Presley, Johnny Cash, the famous recording studio in Memphis, Tennessee, I think called Sun Records or Sun Studios or something like that. If you're a music aficionado, especially of that era of Cash and Elvis, you'll definitely be aware of this studio because it's a historic point where a lot of musicians have recorded their debut singles and even other albums as well. Now it's kind of a tourist trap where you can go on your honeymoon if you want and sing songs, but also at nighttime musicians can still record there, so they can say, I've recorded in the same booth as Elvis Presley. So it's kind of interesting. Anyway, that is interesting in a sense because, you know, if you're a musician, a jobbing musician, you know, you had an interesting life because you played with a lot of the greats of jazz and country and everything like that. But that's not the focus of the documentary, even though that is relevant in certain points. He is a man who walks around and meets racists. He's befriended several high-profile Ku Klux Klan members in America, and a lot of them have left subsequently the Ku Klux Klan because their minds have been opened by conversation. So he's always going around and giving talks to people, even has done a TED talk as well, where he says, if you're talking, you're not arguing. So they might be shouting at you, they might be saying, no, I don't believe that. But at the end of the day, you still have the open dialogue. And that's his greatest lesson, that you have to sit down with your adversary and open the lines of communication. And to be fair, he is like half a dozen or several dozen Ku Klux Klan robes. Now, he gets those when somebody leaves the Ku Klux Klan because of him, because their mind has been open to how racist their thinking previously was. So, you know, it is a proven method as well. Maybe sounds pie in the sky, but he has credible proof that it works, for example. So some amazing things there. He talks about how he's watching Bewitched, not the Irish pop group, when he was interrupted by Walter Cronkite talking about how Martin Luther King had been assassinated, and he's only 10 years old at the time, and he just didn't understand why he couldn't wait. He wanted to watch the show Bewitched, which, to be fair, is a great show. And he went to tell his father and said, this some guy called Martin Luther King has been shot. And he said he'd never seen his father cry before, but his head fell in his hands and he started weeping. And then he started learning how instrumental Martin Luther King was in the civil rights movement, and he became an instant hero for him as well. And you see like the spot where he has been was assassinated in a motel. Very surprising to see, actually, because I assumed he was higher up, because I think he was assassinated by a sniper. But it was only a second-story motel, so he wasn't very high off the ground. But that has since been turned into a museum commemorating African-American history and civil rights history in America. But some amazing stories, though, because his father worked in the Foreign Service, so he traveled quite a lot when he was a kid, and he didn't even realize that was kind of a special thing. He just assumed every kid had his background. But he joined the Cub Scouts, and he walked through some American town with his scout members, and he was allowed to hold the American flag, and then people started throwing things at him, and he just didn't understand why. And then the adults in the scout movement kind of shielded him and took him out. And then he went home, and his parents asked him, well, how did you fall? And he told them what happened, and then they sat him down and said, okay, this is the conversation we're going to have. You know, some people don't like you because you're black. So it's a very compelling story, very well told, because he's a very charismatic man. You see incredible things like these points of historical interest. So even at the Lincoln Memorial, there's a point on the step where Martin Luther King stood to give his famous I Have a Dream speech. But it's not really commemorated. You have like a little writing on the ground, but people walk over it every day and their eyes are just fixed on Abraham Lincoln. So it has like very special places. But even the stories he tells are incredible, because he was playing country music because a John Travolta movie called Urban Cowboy became very popular, and that, you know, people started wanting country music. So that happened in bars. People booked country music bands. So he was playing that all in the South, and because he's a jobbing musician, he had to kind of play country music as well. And then some guy at the break, so they are playing for a while, and then in the middle of sets, you know, he just went to the bar or something, and some white guy put his arm around him and said, man, you are so good at playing the piano, and like, I just can't believe it. And then they had like an argument over who started rock and roll and who started like country music and everything, and who like, you know, who invented rock and roll? Was it Elvis Presley or was it somebody else? And obviously it's like it comes from an African American tradition, even though Elvis Presley was somebody who did very well in that genre as well. But he sat down at the table and he goes, "You're the first black man I've ever seen in my life." And then like the protagonist of the show was like, why? And his friend, the white guy's friend, who was also white, was like jabbing him in the ribs with his elbow, like, tell him. And he's like, "Well, because I'm in the Ku Klux Klan." But he said to him, the Klan member said, "Next time you're here, here's my number, call me. Next time you're playing in this bar, call me. I'll come down and see you." So that's the power of like conversation, talking to a black guy for the first time, but also the power of his music ability, kind of like breaking down the barriers between him and the Klan member. So it's, you know, and there's other stories, but I won't go on and tell you the whole documentary, but it's on Netflix and also YouTube. I would recommend watching it, but it sounds incredible. So when I told you the concept, the very basic concept of changing minds through conversation, you liked it. What was it that kind of grabbed your attention about that?
No, well, it was just the idea that I was just intrigued by the fact that he spoke to them, and you said he actually managed to change some people's minds, and I mean, that's quite something.
There's an interesting thing in the documentary as well, where like there's a guy who works for, if I can remember the name now, some kind of poverty alliance. It's a charity that kind of gives legal advice to poor people, but also as well they battle racists. And the guy who he's interviewing was a white guy, and the African-American protagonist, we'll put the name in the description of the podcast, but because I can't quite think of it right now, but he was like saying, "Oh, there's this Klan member who like he's a friend of mine, and I'm a friend of his, and I've been in his house, you know, having dinner, and we have great conversations." And then the white guy, who's the head of this poverty charity thing, like this legal service, he says, "Well, yeah, that's great. Maybe he's a nice guy. But, you know, what he's doing extends far beyond his family and, you know, his relationship with you. So even though he's a great guy for you, maybe, I don't like him because I think he's doing a lot of damage on a wider scale." So it's kind of interesting because they both have a stake in the story. They both have like credibility as well. Obviously, the African-American has been a civil rights voice for a long time, gives speeches and has suffered racism directly, but also this white guy has been dealing with people like who wanted to leave the Klan, but also people who've been victim of racist violence as well. So they both had very credible and legitimate voices in the conversation as well. So it was very intriguing, but so yeah, I don't know. So now check it out if you want. That's just a little, that could have been in part two as well, actually, but I don't know why I put it in part three. So to finish us off, what do you want to say about plugging us? She should listen to this podcast on some app. I don't know. I can't remember.
Radio Public.
That's the one. So what happens if you listen to us on Radio Public?
That you help us do what we like doing. Some more of this, more conversation, more videos, more everything.
Exactly. So we get money if you listen to us off Radio Public, which is highly appreciated. But of course, if you do listen to us to another podcast app, we also do appreciate that as well. We appreciate the listens and the support. Shout out to Barry, who listened to the podcast recently and enjoyed it. Thank you very much. And also to my mammy, who liked being referenced two podcasts ago. You can find us on LARPA1 is our Twitter handle. LARPAmedia.com is the website. And on YouTube, you'll find us under the handle LARPAmedia as well. So we'll be keeping up to date anyway with our further projects.
products too.
We're launching,
selling new things.
We're launching a new kitchen cleaning spray. Very effective. Kills 99.9% of bacteria. So anything else that we have to say in this part?
Nothing else. Bye, mainly.
Okay. Very good. So I'll let you go first.
Bye-bye.
Bye. The LARPA Podcast. The home for cultural chit-chat in and outside Madrid. People will talk.